Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I'm Tim, here tonight with Lance. Lance, how are you?
Excellent, thank you. How are you?
I'm well. So episode 4, we're talking about that tonight. Episode 4 of Oxygen's series, The Disappearance of Maura Murray, aired last Saturday. And we recorded a Facebook Live session on our Facebook page that we will be doing again this Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern. So check that out on our Facebook page. But this is audio from our Facebook Live session. And so we're going to play that for the majority of this episode again, like we've been doing the past few weeks.
And these Facebook Live after shows have been building some steam here. They've been building some momentum. We got some really good questions, some really excellent observations and feedback. The next episode is going to be crazy. And I mean, we all know that it's going to be crazy. And those people that came out for the Facebook Live last week, come back out this week. You're going to have a lot more questions, and we appreciate that. And it really does generate a lot of renewed interest and maybe some stuff that's been forgotten about in the past. We had some contributors who brought up points to us that we hadn't thought about in a while. And I think this next episode is going to explore one of those theories, one of the major theories out there. And it's a very sometimes convoluted topic. So anything that people can come with that's going to help clear it up, it would be much appreciated. And thank you very much for taking the half hour or so after the show to contribute to it.
So this past episode dealt with the idea or the possibility of a police conspiracy. I would say most of the episode kind of dealt with that. We heard from Officer Cecil Smith, who was the first responder that night, and he admitted to driving SUV 001, the SUV, the police vehicle that everyone thought Chief Jeff Williams was driving. Turns out it was Cecil Smith who was driving that SUV. Pretty kind of ground-shaking information, right, Lance?
Absolutely ground-shaking. And when you're about to as you're listening to him speak and you're hearing the information about the police conspiracy and Jeff Williams and Smith and what happened during the phone calls and what Faith Westman saw and what was reported, one thing maybe to consider, and I didn't consider it until after, is that this isn't really debunking anything. It's a statement sort of facts. And then there's a timeline that goes to those facts, and it really presents a solid explanation of some time that happened during point A to the accident. And take it in. Don't look for things to debunk. Take it in and process it. And that's what we've been doing for the past, you know, week since the show, is processing this and saying, you know, that this wasn't so much debunked as just explained. And that's important.
Right. So Karen McNamara, witness A, she was right about what she saw. She saw an SUV 001 pass her twice. So it must be some vindication for Karen herself and for other people who, you know, really follow this case and swore that they didn't think Karen was lying. And of course, we said it. We said it from the very beginning when we talked to Karen. She did not come off like someone who was lying. She came off very credible. And it is nice to see that she was proven completely accurate on what she saw that night.
So what you're left with after that is the human element. No one knows what's happening right then and there. Karen doesn't know what's happening right then and there. And the people who called the police and 911, they don't know what it is about to become 13 and a half years later. So Karen doesn't look at that scene on the side of the road and pull over and write down in a notebook, it's now 7:31. She doesn't do that because it just looks like a car off the side of the road. So again, yeah, you're going to look at this and you're going to say, well, this is totally explainable. We can get as much information as possible from this. But at some point, there's a human element that comes into play.
Maggie and Art also spoke with
New Hampshire Senior Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Strelzin. That was pretty cool to see him talk. And I think in the episode, it kind of said that we never heard back from him. And that was maybe a little bit of creative editing because we did hear back from him. We did have some emails with him.
Yeah, he was very gracious in the questions that we submitted to him. And you can go back to episode 27, where we talk about the answers that he gave and the non-answers that he gave to our questions, which is, it was great to see him on camera and on TV because the style in which the questions that we presented to him were answered was sort of how I pictured his speech pattern to be. And it was really something interesting to see Strelzin on camera. And because I feel like his presence in that room, they had a really good chemistry, first of all, when they were all in the room and they were talking to him and the way he was answering the questions, he seemed a little bit like an anti-hero to me. And I liked that. Because he's not supposed to be like that in real life. His position in law enforcement is not supposed to be accommodating and forthcoming with people who aren't part of a law, like directly involved in an investigation. You know, these aren't people within his unit coming to him. This is a television crew and an investigative journalist, and he's giving as much as he possibly can. And the fact that he sat in with Smith during that interview, some people might it does seem like that's a little bit perhaps fishy.
Yeah,
but it would have been even more fishy if someone in his position did not sit in on that interview where the first responding officer was about to give his first interview.
Yeah, we talked about this, and we talk about it a little bit in the Facebook Live audio that's coming up, but I think what we kind of came to is it might be for their own safety, like for the state of New Hampshire's safety and these officers' safety, because as we just explained about some of the creative editing that they edited around us saying that we never heard back from the attorney general, which, you know, I was there. I didn't say that. I said, other than some email correspondence, we never heard back from anyone. And so they only use, we never heard back from anyone. So obviously Strelzin is aware that documentaries can do this, and it's not illegal. It's perfectly fine, contractually, all that. In no way is the show fake, but they needed to cover their own bases, I think, cover their own asses, because if there was something in there like, you know, it's like a question from Maggie, what do you think happened that night? And Cecil Smith says, Jeff Williams, you know, and then the cut, go to commercial. And maybe that was just part of the regular conversation where they say, oh, who do people think was supposed to be driving the SUV? And then Cecil Smith answers, Jeff Williams. Well, Attorney General Jeff Strelzin kind of needs to cover his own ass with that, doesn't he? He needs to know exactly what was stated in the room.
Yeah, there's a ton of information as a part of an open investigation. And he's not going to let it go out there anyway, let alone with cameras there on a nationally broadcast TV show. He's not going to just say, oh, you want to talk to Smith? You want to talk to Cecil Smith? Yeah, no, go ahead. Like, I don't need to look at this. That's fine. Go ahead, guys. Go ahead, production team. He should be fired if he did that.
Right. So
if he did not sit in on that.
Right. So on the surface, it does seem shady, and it does. And Maggie even says it. She's like, this is why people don't trust the police up here. And it's a great point and it makes sense. But I think what we described here, kind of looking at it from their perspective a little bit, is where the truth lies in this situation. And before we play the Facebook Live audio, I just want to throw it to a clip from John Smith speaking with us and with a few other people as a part of the CrimeCon Cold Case Club. I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's pretty cool. Check out club.crimecon.com and you can get involved with the Cold Case Club. And it's pretty interesting what they're doing. So basically, last Sunday, there was a radio show or sort of a podcast, I guess you want to say. Bobby Chacone was on, who is a former FBI. So that was pretty cool talking to him a little bit. So check that out. And I think we're going to be on not this Sunday, but the following Sunday after episode 6 airs. We'll be on there with Maggie and Art. So check that out at club.crimecon.com.
Yeah, this clip of John, he does, you need to follow it. You need to follow it. He paints a pretty detailed picture of what happens, who talks to who, and police work. So follow it. It really is sort of like it's like the crux of the whole case, like figuring out these things with police dispatch and rolling up on the scene and et cetera, et cetera. So super interesting.
On February 9th, of course, Maura goes missing, and then Karen hears the report. A couple days later, she calls in to tell the police in Haverhill what she had seen, or what she says not seen, because there was really not much there. And she told them that, and told them that she had seen the black and white number 001 SUV parked nose to nose with a black sedan. And that was all she saw. She didn't see any people or anything. And about 2 days later, someone from the police department, who she believed to be from the police department, called her back and said to her, are you sure that it was the SUV 001 that you saw? And she said, yes, I know it was the SUV 001, because when I come around the corner, I saw it was an SUV, black and white, and it had 001 in the back. And I remember questioning, well, this is years later, but anyway, that was all that basically happened from there. And then about, she had given this information in email to the family. And about a year or so later, when the state police were investigating again, she again called the New Hampshire State Police to tell them what she had seen that night to make sure that they had the information. And in doing so, she was told by someone from the state police that it's not possible for you to have seen the SUV 001 that evening because it was out of commission. Now, she was also contacted by John Healy from the New Hampshire League of Investigators, who told her that it was not possible for her to see that because it was out of commission. So that is two instances where she was told that that vehicle was out of commission. So her story, again, has not changed in 13 and a half years. Now, if indeed she did leave either a little bit early or a little bit late, still puts her in that area long before the 7:46 time of when Cecil Smith was signing off. Now, if he did not sign off at 7:46 or at 7:40, which he says he got there possibly, how can we trust exactly what time he got there as by the FBI agent's statement as just because of that's what he says? It could have been 2 minutes. It could have been 10 minutes. It could have been 12 minutes. Because when you pull up to a scene and all of a sudden you start doing things, minutes start adding up like hours sometimes. So first of all, he says he immediately went to one of the houses. Well, no. The first thing he did was he went to the vehicle and he went around the vehicle. So how come he had not signed off for that 6 to 8 minutes by the time he should have? I mean, when you're rolling up on the scene, you go, H2, PO42, off at the scene. It's as simple as that. So there's a lot of stuff that surrounds that little time frame right there that now kind of has, with Cecil Smith's response, has cut this down to approximately 4 to 5 minutes.
Okay, so before we play this Facebook audio, just wanted to remind you to check out our other podcast called Crawl Space. Check us out on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Twitter at Crawl Space Pod. Lance, what are we talking about over on Crawl Space?
I think the real question is, what aren't we talking about? Because we've developed Crawl Space, where the main focus of the podcast itself is to look into in depth a few different cases. The main ones that we're looking into on Crawl Space, the parent podcast, is the Vanishing Men of Boston, the Dean murder from 100 years ago in New England, a small New England town, and the Breonna Maitland case. Branching off of that, we have the Cellar Series and Vault. Cellar Series is where we discuss topics of criminal psychology and maybe authors who deal with that, or professors, other podcasters in the same genre. And the Vault is more like what do we want to talk about that can get our mind off of this that's fun? That when we get together, we talk about these topics like ghosts.
Oh, man, that was so fun talking about ghosts last week on Crawl Space. Check that one out. It's a Halloween special. It's not something that we get into often, paranormal topics, but it's around Halloween, and I have a personal story, and it was just a fun conversation.
And when we were having that conversation, I remember looking at the clock and thinking, this is definitely going to need to be pared down a little bit, because we could really go on and on about it. And the story that you have, your personal story, every time I think of that story now, I get the song Ring My Bell in my head, which sucks. So I'm actually a little upset that we had to talk about that.
Okay. Well, all right. So let's throw it to this Facebook Live audio. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. We will be back Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on our Facebook channel. Link is in the show notes. We will be doing a Facebook Live show. And obviously, check out Oxygen's episode 5, The Disappearance of Maura Murray, 7-6 Central on Oxygen. And it replays again at 9-8 Central. Trust me, episode 5 is fucking crazy. What do you think about episode 4?
A whole new direction, right? I mean, we knew at some point that they were going to breach the topic of police conspiracy. To see Smith and to see Strelzin, to see those two come together in the state police barracks, to see that interview happen was amazing, right? That's something that we've wanted to see for quite a while.
Right. So you're referring to the end of the episode where Officer Cecil Smith, who was the first on the scene, supposedly going by the police logs, that night, February 9th, Cecil Smith was first on the scene. And we see also Jeffrey Strelzin, but John Monahan, who's right. been long talked about as the sort of mystery law enforcement that was found on the scene, or not found on the scene, but was he on the scene? Was he not on the scene?
Apparently on the scene in an unofficial way.
Right.
And a lot can be made for his participation that night. Mm-hmm. A lot of people will look at that and say he didn't do his job. But again, we always come back to, well, what was the job at the time? Trying to find somebody who was possibly drunk and just abandoning a car. And when we were watching it, the question that Art had asked about, you didn't knock on doors, you didn't go like door to door. That really wasn't his jurisdiction to do that.
Or Monahan's
jurisdiction. Yeah, not jurisdiction. I want to say it wasn't his duty to do that. He was assisting because he was there. Like a general assistance, I think they called it. That's more about the local police. And honestly, how many doors are there in the area to knock on? There had already been knocked on. What did strike me was that Butch Atwood was sent out to look, or volunteered, or instructed to go look.
Yeah. Okay. So let's. We're getting to the end of the episode already, but that's okay.
Right.
That's fine. Let's just go straight there. So Cecil Smith says that John Monahan says that Cecil Smith said, I sent Butch to go search. Or maybe not, but that's what he did. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, he sent Butch to go search west. So he searched towards the Mountain View Mountain Lakes area, where we had the vigil in 2015 or 2016.
Right, exactly.
So about a mile west. So that's interesting that Butch went out there. What did you make of that Butch went out there?
I don't know how small town police investigations work, or police response works, because it wasn't really an investigation at that point, right? So I do think it's weird, but maybe it's common to send a witness to the he was a witness to the accident. It is a little strange in my head, but maybe it's just revisionist history.
He must have just trusted him right away for whatever reason. He specified that I didn't know Butch before.
Right, exactly.
Which is pretty interesting that he bothered to volunteer that information when no one asked him that. Obviously, Maggie pointed that out as well.
Right.
That was pretty interesting.
And yeah, Jason Watts says the plot certainly thickened. Yeah, it has. So Cecil Smith was driving 001. According to what we just saw, he says he was driving 001. There's some...
The SUV.
The yeah. SUV 001. There's some question as to whether... What he's referred to in the dispatch log.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Zoom out real quick.
Sorry.
So... So witness A, Karen, believes that she saw 001, SUV 001, and there's only one SUV in the whole town, as John Smith says in the episode. And so witness A saw this SUV pass her twice on the road. And so what we found out tonight was Cecil Smith, who was first on the scene, said, actually, that was me in the SUV. I don't know who you thought it was. Obviously, who everyone thought it was Jeffrey Williams, who comes up as well, but was not spoken to in this episode.
Right, because the perception is that the chief of police drives 001.
Right.
And 001 was the SUV. And then you look into all of that and what John Smith has said about, and not just John Smith, what has been said about Jeff Williams. Mm-hmm. It does... cause a bit of suspicion. If anybody, we have Witness A's interview on one of our episodes. Off the top of my head, I can't remember what number that episode is.
Yeah, we'll find out.
And that was with Alex and Witness A, and he arranged the interview. He performed the interview, which was awesome. And
episode 30.
And Alex speaks with Witness A, Karen, and if you want to get a more extended version of that, I would check that out, because she does go into a lot of the same things, but then a lot of details that just aren't in this episode.
Lance, what do you think of the eyeglass company Warby Parker?
Well, I've often told you how much of a fan I am of Warby Parker. My first pleasurable eyeglass experience was going to Warby Parker on Newberry Street in Boston and having them personally attend to me and put glasses that, I mean, you've seen my face. It's hard to put anything around my face and make it look good.
Mm-hmm.
So they came right up and I said, I know I have this... Elephant man like thing going on. Could you find the right glasses? And since that day, I've been a Warby Parker loyalist.
You say elephant man. I feel like I see that guy from The Hills Have Eyes, the original one. But anyway, did you try the free home try-on program? Because I guess you can order 5 pairs of glasses and try them on for 5 days. And there's still no obligation to buy.
I did try the free 5 pairs of glasses for 5 days. Unfortunately, and it's really cool, you can go online and you can pick out the styles you like, and I struck out every time. But Warby Parker is totally cool about it. They provide free shipping, a prepaid return shipping label, so you can just return it, you can just drop it into any post box, and we even had an email exchange after, and I said I couldn't find the right pair, and they reply with, well, you know, anything we can do to help you get the perfect pair of glasses, let us know.
Well, if you go to warbyparker.com/missing, you can order your free home try-on today. And the glasses start at $95, including prescription lenses. Lenses include anti-glare and anti-scratch coatings, which is pretty cool.
Also pretty cool, did you know that for every pair you buy, a pair is distributed to someone in need?
Oh my God, I did not know that. That sounds incredible. So check out warbyparker.com/missing to order your free home try-on now. Also, check out the Warby Parker iTunes app. After ordering your home try-on, check out the app.
All
Okay, so Alex, actually, speaking of Alex, he mentions here in the chat, he says that he doesn't trust some of Cecil Smith's answers and right. had a feeling we were going to get this response. So he says, I've always been under the impression that the Westman said Smith arrived in the sedan, and when asked about the 001 scenario, they said they never saw an SUV at the scene. So that would be quite interesting. I don't know that off the top of my head. I can't point to where they said that there was never an SUV on the scene. So if you have that, please send that to us. That would be fascinating to see. He also says Smith said Atwood described Maura leaning on the car appearing drunk.
Right, which is awesome. Sorry to interrupt, but that's awesome because there have been conflicting reports about what Butch has said. Was she in the car? Was she out of the car? And according to what we just saw tonight, it was the presumption that she might have been a little tipsy and needing to hold on to something, which means she was standing outside of her car.
If it was Smith in SUV 001, why did police sound so confounded by its presence there that night when returning Karen's call? That is a really good question. So they returned Karen's call and said, are you sure you saw the SUV there that night or SUV 001 that night? So that was one that is pretty interesting. What'd you make of that?
Well, looking back over the police logs and the dispatch records that we have, certain numbers are assigned to certain officers. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand here, it's ID P042 Smith. And H2 is apparently the car that he was driving. However, you can connect H2 to a sedan or the SUV is really what we need to come down to. Is H2 what he was driving, and is H2 an SUV, or is it a sedan? So cool. I was looking at what Alex was writing right there, and always been under the impression, like you had asked him, always been under the impression that the Westmans said Smith arrived in the sedan. Mm-hmm. And when asked about 001, they said they never saw any SUV at the scene. I've been looking through the police dispatch. I can't find it here. So if there's any documentation, any...
What do you see in the police reports?
I see that Smith was dispatched and they ID him. It says ID P042 Smith. Shows when he was dispatched, when he was en route, when he arrived, and when he cleared. And the narrative, H2, is I'm under the assumption that H2 is the vehicle that he was driving.
Okay, so it's not H2 isn't assigned to the person, and
it's not assigned to the person. H2 is the vehicle.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hmm.
Okay, so that's conflicting with the police reports. You're saying what they said to Maggie and Art.
I don't know, because okay. I could be reading this wrong.
Alex goes on to say his last point here: if Smith didn't know Atwood at all, why enlist him to help search for Maura? Great question. I don't know.
Maybe it's just small town trust.
Yeah. It seemed like he trusted him. I mean, just you could picture that scenario. I feel like based on what we heard tonight that it's like, oh, hey, you want to go look? Or maybe he's just like, oh, I'll go look.
Yeah. And Atwood has said in the I think it's a Caledonian Record. His reports has said that he took a ride around the back roads. He was gone for about 15 minutes. Then he took a ride to French Pond. And French Pond is out by the Swift Water store. Mm-hmm. So apparently he was directed to go
right.
in the direction of French Pond.
Okay.
And he was gone for about 15 minutes.
Interesting.
So if what he said here in the newspapers is accurate, and this is from Gary Lindsay. Gary Lindsley. And this was written in, I believe it was right after. This might have been like June or something of 2004. It's pretty close to when the actual occurrence like took place. And if what he's saying here is what we just heard tonight, then he was directed to go take a ride around the back roads, gone about 15 minutes, then took a ride to French Pond. Mm-hmm.
Maria here says, witness A said she didn't see any people. Is that weird? And that's a good question.
Right. It is weird.
So Witness A drives by, and theoretically there should be two people there.
Or at least a police officer standing outside of a car.
Right, so Maura must have already left if that's really what she saw. You know, no one there, and her eyes didn't deceive her. Then Maura had already left, and Cecil was talking with a neighbor, I guess. Or searching or something.
Let me drop a little bit more on you here with the timeline.
Uh-oh.
Atwood says he was gone for about 15 minutes. So we can put 15 minutes at, let's back it up a little bit, when he was instructed to go search. That was after the 743 call, right? And he gets back in his bus, and that's when he says that the officer knocked on his bus, and that's when the conversation happened. Mm-hmm. So let's put that at, like, if it's 743, let's put it at 746,
okay.
747. And then he said he was gone 15 minutes, took a ride to French Pond.
So a little past 8.
Right. And when he says... He drove a mile down the road to the store in Swiftwater to check and see if she was there. She wasn't. When he returned to the accident scene, a New Hampshire State Police trooper was there. So this is Moynihan.
Okay. Yep.
Right.
That's Moynihan. Yep.
So what would that what time would that put us at? I was gone for about 15 minutes and I took a ride. A little past 8.
Yep.
Okay. I just want to this article right here sets a pretty semi-concrete timeline.
Okay.
Little past 8, that's when the state trooper was there.
Okay.
At the accident scene, he says.
Wow. Yeah, it's a lot of information to dissect here. I got all these things I wrote down, and I haven't checked off any of them yet.
Right.
So, I like that Moynihan searched Butson's, which was Shaw's, I believe, at the time. Or it's Shaw's now, and it was Butson's then. So John Moynihan said that he pulled the tapes from Butson's and said there was nothing there. So it wasn't Maura.
So wrap that one up.
Yeah, wrap that one up. Yeah. That sighting wasn't Maura.
Yep.
He could have been a little more thorough with his answer and been like, oh yeah, I saw who the sighting was about and it wasn't Maura, but I think we can take that for it wasn't Maura.
And I like what Alex is saying here with the black box. There have been 7 unsuccessful attempts to restart the car. That alone speaks volumes.
It really does.
That means that that wasn't where she wanted to leave the car.
Right.
Also, the Marats saw reverse lights.
Mm-hmm.
That means she's tried to get her car out. She's trying to back it up.
Yep.
And we have Fred saying, you know, whether the advice he gave her was good or bad, right or wrong... He said 100%, I told her, if your car's sputtering and smoking, put the rag in the tailpipe. That might get you by.
Yeah.
Probably won't, but it might. And she probably had that in her head. If I put the rag in the tailpipe, I can get out of this. I can get out of this area. And it proved to be not successful. So I do like that that the rag in the tailpipe, that big mystery, that big red herring is probably wrapped up right now.
Chloe says, Art said in his interview with Nancy Grace, which is a great interview, you should really check that one out, that Cecil said that he could have arrived to the site as soon as 7:40 before he called it in. So what do you have, Lance? I ask you, what do you have in these police records right here in front of you? That's like attached to your hip.
Cecil Smith, according to the dispatch logs, was dispatched at 7:29, was en route within the same minute, and arrived at 7:46.
So Cecil arrived at 7:46.
Yep, according to the dispatch log.
Okay.
Cecil arrived at 7:46.
Okay.
One thing that that was brought up was, did she or did she not walk into the woods?
It didn't. I mean, it doesn't seem like it. They searched the immediate area that night, at least for footprints.
But according to Strelzin, did she or did she not walk into the woods?
According to Strelzin, he said you can't confirm or say it didn't happen.
Right. And then it's, well, she got out of her car and she could have been hiding behind a tree. Well, you can't really say that if there were no footprints in the woods. Hmm. No one looked that night, but wouldn't there be some sort of disruption behind a tree? Wouldn't there be something?
Or some footprints to get to that tree.
Yeah. I mean, she's hiding behind a tree. She's not standing in the same spot the whole time.
Yeah.
And right. Then, so and you're then she could.
She did that. Yeah.
Right. And then just, I do appreciate what he did. I do appreciate the information that he provided and the questions that he answered with us as well.
Mm-hmm.
But when asked about what do you think happened, he doesn't answer anything. And maybe that's just because it's like the open case. Like, he can't answer anything, but he is a, like Maggie said, he just has non-answers.
It's a non, that one's a non-answer like we give.
That is, yeah, that's a, yeah.
It really is. It's like, well, I don't know. I mean, is the responsible answer. He's not going to say, oh, I think she was murdered, or I think she committed suicide. He's going to keep them all open because they have to be open to him, because he's, you know, prosecuting the case and he's investigating it still.
Right. And Jeffrey here says, have to remember they weren't thinking anything was wrong. Most likely it was just a cursory scan of the area. That's true.
That's what he said.
Right, exactly. But then he says, but then he kind of contradicts himself and, you know, well, we have the area that doesn't have footprints going out there. And then he says, well, she could have been 20 feet away behind a tree.
Yeah.
I just think it's an irresponsible thing to say. Yeah. When we already know that there was nothing going into the woods in the first place. And yeah, it definitely was just a cursory scan of the area. Yeah. They thought it was somebody ditching a car.
Right. Sierra Hare says that it's weird that Cecil immediately volunteered why he would be driving the SUV. Seems contrived. And I kind of see what she's saying. It seems like Cecil was obviously expecting the question, so I guess his answer probably would have been contrived, even if he's telling the truth.
Yeah, and a lot of people were saying that he seemed nervous.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to also account for the fact that there were cameras and a crew there, and he'd never done an interview before, so he probably was a little bit nervous.
This is the first time he had ever spoken, Lance.
Ever.
Ever spoken publicly.
Yeah.
Melissa says, would they have even checked down that way? down past Bradley Hill Road. Monahan would have come from that direction. So if Maura took off running east, Monahan should have seen her, unless she did jump into the woods and hide from the car, the cop car coming down the road. Which is a possibility, because if she had jumped into the woods, say, or off the road, then they wouldn't have seen the footprints that night. They probably didn't go that far. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If she got past Bradley Hill Road and dodged Monahan coming that way, she could have, you know, kept going.
Michelle here has an interesting point that I think we just kind of pass over. A person crashed who was likely drinking, which was just stated by Smith, that he saw the box of wine in the back of the car. And they didn't think it was warranted, and they didn't think it warranted a thorough search. It's negligent. That's a great point, because people, you know, and I keep falling back on, well, they didn't think anything was wrong. But if you do see that someone was drinking and they're not around the car and there's evidence of it in the car, is it negligent to not thoroughly search? And we have the log here that says, has she arrived at the cottage? H2 clear of scene. Lavoie's has a vehicle. Any luck locating the party, or has she shown at cottage hospital? So they were aware that there was somebody, out there.
Mm-hmm. Right. They assumed she would show up at the hospital. Why? I wonder.
Yeah, right.
Maybe that's just what happens if someone goes missing from a car, generally, a car accident, generally.
Yeah, maybe someone called something. Yeah, no, because we would know that. What, did she just walk there? Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Oh, what about Strelzin sitting in on Cecil Smith and John Monahan's interviews? How did you feel about that?
Well, you know, it's probably right down to there's information here that these guys are going to talk about. There's questions that are going to be asked, and he probably just wanted to make sure that, just doing his job, make sure that what the answers are, what the questions are, fit within a realm of what he thinks is necessary to be disseminated to the public.
Okay.
I think he wanted to monitor it. Maybe he wanted more screen time, but I think he wanted to monitor what information was being talked about, just as part of his position.
So let's play this out a little bit, okay? So at what point does Strelzin stop the interview? Like, what is he looking for to be said for him to have stopped that interview?
Maybe he's not looking for anything, but...
Well, why he was sitting there because he was waiting to stop the interview if something was said.
Right.
What would have been... I mean, obviously, okay, total extreme, like, you know... Oh, I don't even know, actually. What is the extreme? I was going to say, like, oh, like a confession to Maura Murray, and why would Strelzin stop that? Or if he says, I know who, you know, for example, Jeff Williams really did it, why would he stop that?
It could be that maybe the things that Moynihan and Smith would say might inadvertently be a fact or lead to something that they have as an open investigation in this case, and they don't realize it.
Right.
So they might start talking about something, and he might say, you want to wrap that up because... That might be tipping somebody else off.
If this goes to a criminal court case, I might not be able to use something.
Exactly. I don't think he was looking for something specific. Yeah. I think he was listening. I think he just needed to listen. Maybe he was even listening just because he wanted to hear what they were saying.
Right.
Maybe there was going to be some new information. I actually think, now that I'm talking about it, I actually think that I love the fact that he was there.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, it doesn't look as shady now after talking about it. If he's actually doing his job, then he wants to know what these guys are going to say. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, it's better hearing about what is going to come out in the documentary, hearing about it when it's filmed so you know what was said.
But beyond that.
Other than just being surprised tonight.
Right.
You know,
but beyond that, I think he might have, if he had the best intentions for the case and the investigation, he's not going to just not listen to what the state police and the first arriving officer is going to say, no matter if it's to us or to Maggie and Art.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his position in the state, he needs to be there.
Yeah. What about when he said that one of the reasons they don't give a lot of information out is because we want to hold some stuff back, because if the killer knows it, we want to know that only the killer would have been able to know that. They hold stuff back from the press for that reason, is what he said. It sounds almost like investigator, like detective romantic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
See, I feel like it hardly ever happens, right? What are the chances that really happens?
Who knows? Probably more often than we know.
Yeah, you're probably right.
You know, we don't work in that realm that, like they do all the time.
Yeah. It seems like it would happen in a movie to me.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that it wouldn't happen.
But we haven't been to court. Like, they go to court as their job. And they probably see so many situations where someone said something they shouldn't have. And all of a sudden, every piece of evidence is out the window now.
Yeah.
Because that was not gathered properly. Or that, you know, someone spoke too loosely. And what do we think about Smith volunteering the information about Butch?
Yeah, that was pretty interesting. I think because he knows the theory. I mean, that's what I'll go with. I think it sounds feels like natural. Like, a lot of people would do that. Like, if you know what you're going to get asked, like, he probably jumped the gun answering it, I think, a couple of times. But I agree. It's a little weird. It was kind of blurted out. Like, I think that's a natural way to go. Like, if you think, oh, you know, Cecil Smith knows more about where Moore is, or Butch knew more, or something like that, it's like, well, who knew each other? Did Williams know Smith? Did Atwood know Williams? You know what I mean?
And are we opening up a whole new can of worms that we shouldn't be? Maybe maybe Smith is just like wound tight because of the interview.
And he's
probably sitting there thinking, I need to say something right now. I need to say that I don't know him. I didn't know him. And then he probably said it and thought, oh, shit. Like, what was I thinking? Why did I just say that? It could just be nerves.
Yeah.
And maybe we're just starting a whole new rag in the tailpipe red herring.
Yeah. Sonia says, what did it feel like to finally see and hear from Cecil Smith?
What a great question, because I still don't know if it's Cecil or Cecil.
It seemed pretty clear that it was Cecil.
He looks more like a Cecil. He's not what I thought he would look like.
I mean, I don't even know what I pictured. Yeah, I didn't really picture anything. But yeah, it was pretty cool. It was, I agree, he wasn't what you pictured. Who knows what anyone would picture, but it was pretty cool to see him and finally hear some answers from Cecil.
Right, because he's been this like folklore character.
Right.
The first person at the scene. You know, when we first started looking into this, and even when Texas Crew and Oxygen started looking into this, it's really tough to find information on him.
Right.
And to finally see him, he was kind of mythological.
He is a little bit, yeah. Chloe says, based on the photos of the accident scene 2 days later, I think if Maura went into the woods, her sneakers and jeans would have been soaked through, at least at the ankles, based on the level of snow. But I want to say that a few people in here, Lauren and someone else, was saying that I am about 115 pounds, and I wonder if I could have walked on the frozen snow without it breaking through.
No.
But I will say, like, there is times during the winter when even I can walk on snow without it breaking through.
Right. But you're talking about, like, that's over the course of several storms. And
usually, yeah. I would say so, yeah.
And you only walk on that if you're, like, ginger about it.
Yep.
Yeah. There'd have to be something. If she's
I'm a little actually, heavier than Maura, though.
Well, you're, like, 120.
Thanks. Peter Milner. What's up, Clint? He says, what role did you guys think a threat of a lawsuit for negligence has in the way police have acted publicly about the case?
I have to read that again. What role do you think a threat of a lawsuit of negligence has in the way police, like threatening Murray's, a lawsuit against the police for negligence?
Yes.
I think that's very, very, very slim.
Okay. Why?
Because the car was found.
I guess the question is why, or do you think that the threat of that would have any effect on the way the police have acted about this case?
I probably think that they don't think about that. I think that they deal with their investigations.
Yeah.
I think a threat of a lawsuit, they probably, if it ever comes through, they probably think, okay, we'll get our lawyers on this and we'll keep working on a case. Maybe I hold too much faith in police officers, but I know more really good police officers than I do bad police officers.
Right, and a good call by Fred there when he said, you know, he said exactly that. There are good police officers and there are bad police officers. They shouldn't be held on some, you know, holy regard. He said something like that. And it's a good point. You know, you see that everywhere in this country.
Right, exactly. You're not part of a police force. This is a great point actually from Clint or Peter. You're that law enforcement industry, and I feel weird saying industry, but that like the law enforcement industry must deal with that on a daily basis. They absolutely deal with it on a daily basis. So a threat of that for negligence probably doesn't faze them that much.
Mm-hmm. Nancy says, if it's true what Monahan is saying, why is he now a chief in Franconia? If he is only the only one who can patrol east, why would he go west?
It wasn't like he was called to the scene.
Yeah.
It was a casual assistance.
Right. And I thought that was interesting that it was cleared up why Monahan's superiors at the time didn't know that Monahan was on the scene. And I forget what he was called exactly.
It was like a general assistant.
I think my kid screamed right at the exact moment that those words.
She was shocked. She was shocked by what he said.
We all were. But that's interesting to know that's why. So there wasn't a formal report that Monahan would have ever filled out because he kind of considered it barely helping, I guess.
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, they say it's a general assistance report.
Yeah. Did Monahan ever say why he signed off at a hotel from Wanda? I don't know. I don't know what to say about that one. You, Lance?
I mean, to say anything would be just speculating, so I don't know. Well, what's the question? Did he ever say why he signed off at a hotel?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
He never said why.
John Smith said it best about Williams. Where is Maura Murray?
Yeah.
Quite a dramatic moment heading out to commercial. But maybe this show will talk to Williams. I'm not really sure. Do you have anything else, Lance?
No, other than we really need to figure out what numbers are assigned to the vehicles.
Yeah.
What's H2? What is H2? Because H2 is what, according to the dispatch, H2 is what Smith was driving. So what is H2?